Today we're playing a bonus episode because we're still working on our special final episode of our first season of The Colour Cycle. We can't wait to share it with you.
If only a bit of hummus, souvlaki, dim sum or pho were enough to cure people of prejudice and bigotry.
Hi, and welcome to a special bonus episode of The Colour Cycle, a podcast that aims to disrupt cultural whitewashing and asks, do our arts and screens look like Australia? I'm Lina Nahlus from Diversity Arts Australia, or DARTS for short, an organisation that advocates for an arts and screen sector that looks like Australia. We're still working on our final episode that will come out next week, and after that we've got a few more bonus episodes lined up, so we hope you'll join us for those. Before we introduce our bonus episode, I want to acknowledge the traditional custodians of Australia from over 500 Indigenous nations and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We've heard a lot about not seeing yourself reflected in the arts and culture of the society in which you live and the dehumanising effects this can have on people. So is creative expression a human right? Dr. Sut Pomasan, the Race Discrimination Commissioner at the Australian Human Rights Commission, will probably convince you that it is. His opening speech at the Beyond Tick Boxes Symposium was so good, we wanted to share it with our podcast listeners in full. Trust me, you're going to love this episode. Yet curiously for Tim, by pointing out the lack of diversity in the media and in Australia's political and corporate life in his speech and to a Senate inquiry, Australia's race commissioner attracted a huge backlash, with one commentator on Sky News calling for him to go back to where he came from. Now that's something that many culturally diverse artists have no doubt heard at one time in their life. So have a listen to Tim's speech, The Right to Arts and Creative Diversity, and judge for yourself whether it was a radical call.
And can I also begin by acknowledging the Cabral people of the Darug Nation and acknowledge them as the traditional owners of the land on which we meet. Also want to acknowledge Lina Nahlus and everyone at DARTS. Congratulations on the relaunch. And thank you for all the important work that you do in empowering the creative arts and advocating for diversity in the arts. And I can think of no better place for your conversation today than here in Casula. We like to think of Australia as a bit of a powerhouse of multiculturalism. If that is the case, then you can find no more emblematic engine room than Southwest Sydney. And like Patrick Abud. I'm also a product of Southwest Sydney, and in fact, this powerhouse was part of the landscape of my daily journey to high school. I used to be on the train and get the train from Cabramatta to Glenfield, so I used to pass this power station when it was still, I believe, derelict and was adjacent to a nine-hole golf course, which I see is no longer here, but it is a great success story, this powerhouse, and an indication of what can be done in diversity and the arts here in Sydney. As I've said, we're a multicultural society, and emphatically so, but I think we can all agree that we can do better to ensure that the arts in this country does better at reflecting and representing our diversity. You've heard some of the figures that have already been cited. This is more than just a cosmetic concern. It's more than just a worry about the aesthetic presentation of our society. Too often, the issue of diversity is dismissed, consigned as an afterthought by those who don't understand its importance. And too often, the issue is reduced to an administrative or bureaucratic exercise in ticking boxes. And the reason is this: if you are someone who can see yourself or someone like you on stage or on screen or in our media, you've never really had to ask questions about why people like you were left out. You've never known the feeling of looking into society's mirror without seeing yourself reflected. The writer Benjamin Law recently put it in this way, quite striking. He quoted from the Dominican American writer Junot Diaz, who said, and I quote, "There's the idea that monsters, vampires, don't have reflections in a mirror. What I've always thought isn't that monsters don't have reflections in a mirror. It's that if you want to make a human being into a monster, deny them, at the cultural level, any reflection of themselves." As Law reflected, and I quote, "When I first heard that quote, I knew exactly what he meant. Growing up without seeing yourself reflected back in your nation's stories is a quietly dehumanizing thing." Here, then, is the connection between the arts and human rights. I believe there's a real challenge to ensure that the language of human rights doesn't begin and end with conventions or in abstract principles. If we were to boil down the idea of human rights to its most basic proposition, it is this. It is that everyone is born equal in rights and dignity. There is no human right, of course, for people to be reflected in the arts or in media. But we can all appreciate, at least I'd hope we can all appreciate, that someone's dignity can be connected with how they, or to be more specific, the group they belong to, are depicted in the public sphere. And where a group in society is invisible or demeaned, the message is evident. Those in that group are outsiders, second-class members, or even an other against whom society defines itself. Our current public debates about cultural diversity can leave some feeling unwelcome or incompatible with our broader society. Consider some of the responses to the census this week. We've already touched on that. As you would know, the census confirmed the reality of a multicultural Australian society. More than a quarter of us were born overseas, and as has been the case for a number of decades now, Asia has increasingly become the source of migrants who arrive in Australia. But the manner in which some media outlets have reported on the census this week has been nothing short of breathless in its emphasis on Asian migrants and Islam. Here's a sample of some of the headlines in our newspapers. "Migrant nation born as Christian heritage fades." "Muslim population in Australia soars to 600,000 as religion becomes the nation's second biggest. A 77% jump in the past decade," in capitals, according to census. Or this: "Welcome to Chinatown. How Sydney has become more Asian than European with 500% rise in Chinese-born residents." All headlines I've taken from newspapers and websites this week. And the clear implication to be drawn from these headlines and the accompanying reporting is that Australia is now at risk of losing its British, European, Western or Christian heritage, of becoming too Asian or too Islamic, that the social change brought by migration is threatening an Australian identity or way of life. Well, the reality is more sober. It is true that the majority of migrants who now settle in Australia are from countries in Asia, but it is untrue to suggest that the population in general, or the population at large, has become more Asian than European in background. The United Kingdom, in fact, remains the largest single source of residents born overseas in this country. Four of the five most common ancestries reported in Sydney from the census are Australian, Irish, Scottish, and English. And while Muslims living in Australia may have grown in number over the past 5 years, they represent 2.6% of the population. This is up from 2.2% in 2011. Based on these figures, it is a stretch to suggest their numbers have soared. In terms of religious affiliation, those numbers who have soared are those who have no religion, a group that now constitutes 30% of the population. 30%. Now, the cumulative effect of media coverage this week, though, has been to encourage some panicked anxiety about Australia being overwhelmed, if not by Asians, then by Muslims. Consider now another example in our public debate, the proposal from the federal government for a revamped citizenship test that would include a more demanding test of prospective citizens' English. Namely, the proposed test, as many of you would know, would require prospective citizens to demonstrate proficiency in English at the IELTS Level 6, equivalent to the standard that many Australian universities require of international students from non-English speaking countries. Again, the effect of this debate has been to signal that some groups are either undesirable or are incompatible with Australian society. Anyone who may fall short of having a spoken and written command of English, that is consistent with the university level standard, would, under the proposed changes, be excluded from becoming citizens. Moreover, there have been suggestions that the citizenship test is required as a measure to protect Australians against threats to national security. Were the clock wound back and the proposed standard adopted in the past, it would mean that many who have settled here in Australia would not have been able to become citizens. Indeed, there are many Australian-born citizens who would likely find it difficult to meet the standard of IELTS 6, perhaps even many parliamentarians who might find it difficult to meet that standard. It is strange to think that we are contemplating right now holding naturalised citizens to a standard that many Australian-born citizens couldn't meet. In recent weeks, many Australians on social media and traditional media have shared their family stories, stories of fathers and mothers who may have come to Australia as migrants speaking little or no English, or who may still be able only to speak conversational English. Stories of refugees who have studied Australian history and politics, who've had to take the citizenship test on multiple occasions before passing. Stories of people whose place in Australia is now being placed under question. Which brings me to the one thing that the arts must do on cultural diversity. It must give voice to the lived experience of multicultural Australia. When you're not in the majority, it can be harder not only to be seen, but to be heard. And the arts must give voice to those who aren't always able to enjoy a platform or who have the power to speak up. It must make some lived experiences more visible as well. Too often, our multicultural character remains only partially glimpsed. The arts must also consciously question the status quo. Now, this has always been the role of the arts, to challenge, to disrupt, to speak truth to power, to empower, to inspire, to force viewers, listeners, audiences to confront injustices and to contemplate change. Yet all too often on cultural diversity, I believe we tread too cautiously. We are afraid of pushing others into discomfort. We are mindful of not causing offence to others. We see this in the way that food is used. Food is used as the dominant vehicle for interacting with cultural diversity. Now, we can all be comfortable around culinary diversity. All of us know how to relax over food and drink. I've heard many tell me that there's no better way to learn about another culture than to share a meal with someone from another culture or break bread with someone from a different country. If only a bit of hummus souvlaki, dim sum, or pho were enough to cure people of prejudice and bigotry. Nonetheless, I believe it is true that we often regard the advent of modern Australian, with a capital M and A cuisine, as a genuinely true or genuine sign of cultural sophistication. But thinking in that way can act as a convenient excuse not to engage more deeply with cultural differences. At its worst, culinary multicultural triumphalism celebrates the transactional benefit of cultural diversity. You are free to come here, you are free to give us your food, and we are glad to have it. Diversity then becomes a mere ornament of cultural life, in the way that Buddha statues adorn many backyards, or in the way that Aboriginal paintings decorate many living room walls. And so it is that many come to regard diversity as something that adds to the life of the general culture without giving due recognition to the bearers of the diversity. Multiculturalism becomes a bargain. Those who share their cultural expressions do so for the purpose of widening the cultural choices of a majority in exchange for their presence being accepted or tolerated. Whether there is mutual respect generated through that exchange is perhaps another thing. But this is a thing, a task, that is surely incumbent on the creative arts to pursue, for you to pursue. And it goes to the mission of the arts when they flourish, to nurture creativity, to foster exchange, to encourage understanding and respect. For those of you working for diversity in the arts, this task has become more urgent than ever. I hope that you enjoy the next 2 days of deliberations, and I look forward to hearing more about what you discuss and how you will work to strengthen diversity in Australia's arts. Thank you.
That was Dr. Tim Soutphommasane, Australia's Race Discrimination Commissioner, with the opening speech at the Beyond Tick Boxes Symposium at Casula Powerhouse last year. Thanks for joining us for this bonus episode of the Colour Cycle podcast, made by Diversity Arts Australia, an organisation that advocates for an arts and screen sector that looks like Australia. Make sure you subscribe to the Colour Cycle on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Go to diversityarts.org.au for more information about our work. There's stacks on our website, including videos. This bonus episode was produced by Jennifer Macy from Audiocraft. Tarek Sawirez composed the opening and closing music. I'm Lena Nahlous. Thanks for listening, and yalla bye.